25 past, I think we'll start. Could I say hello and welcome to Learning Publishing Live, or in some cases almost live, given last night, or in fact, from some people. I'm Alan Singleton, editor of Learned Publishing, which all members will know about, but non-members might not always available free to members, and hard copy and online versions. One of the good things about being editor of Learned Publishing is you don't actually have to know anything about anything, and but you need to know a few people who do, and I'm hoping to get away with that in this session as well, because we have a whole selection of people who know a lot about most things to do with publishing, and I'm going to quickly introduce them. On my left here is Diane Scott-Lichter, who is North American editor of Learned Publishing, but also publisher of the American Association for Cancer Research. Did I get that right?
You
this
did.
Time?
You got it very right.
And if you can look at her resume and see that she's had a long, not that long, but a very quite long and varied career, which seems to have almost oscillated between learned society and commercial publishers. So she's very familiar with both environments. Next, I have Pippa Smart, who will be known to many of you. She's books review editor of Learned Publishing, but also has over 25 years' experience in the industry. And personally, I can recall her mainly from an initiative of INASP, which most of you will know about, with developing countries. Very wide-ranging, knows lots about everything. And next is Vivian Berkhan. I've only met at this conference, and you can see from her resume that she's been at a number of publishers and now specializes in humanities, social sciences, and particularly books, and is managing director of Berkhan Books, which she tells me was founded by her mother. And then last but not least on the end there, we have Bob Campbell, who is probably one of the most experienced, that doesn't just mean old, and well-respected publishers on the planet, who knows just about everything to do with publishing, and I think I'm right in saying he spent virtually his whole career at Blackwell's and Wiley Blackwell's, and has led many of the major initiatives in scholarly publishing, and may yet lead many more. So that's your panel. I'm told to, the only housekeeping thing I've been asked to do is to urge people to fill in their Survey Monkey about the conference. There's a thing in your pack that gives you the address to go to fill in the survey about the conference, so I've done my duty on that. And ALPSB, of course, one of the main things it does is to try to help its members, and it obviously does that through training and seminars and conferences like this. It also has on its website, which is due for quite a revamp, guidelines or advice notes. And there are some 40 of these covering a wide range of issues, from licensing, I've just written a few down, metadata, impact factor, working with Google, all kinds of, how to deal with libel, all kinds of things. And I had a word with Sarah, who's just coming. The other day, and she confirmed those are going to be revamped, looked at, and always looking for suggestions about things that they'd like advice on. They also have a report coming out, I should mention, which is about 9 or 10 case studies of people who've gone into e-books. And I've read that, and there's an incredibly valuable introduction by Linda Bennett, about 30 pages, which is not just an introduction, it's almost a primer on how to do it. So if any of you are looking for something like that, when this report comes out, which I think is going to be October or Frankfurt, it's an extremely valuable document to take people through all the things you need to know if you haven't got into e-books and want to. And then in Learned Publishing, we try to produce things that could actually be of help and interest to societies. Over the last year, we've had lots of stuff about cross-mark, cross-check, plagiarism, a review of plagiarism in the law, so you can see where you stand on that, the journal usage statistics portal, how to start selling to Russia, Brazil coming up in the next one, how publishers are responding to the issues of data, understanding the Creative Commons license are very clear. It was surprising to me how little I knew about the varieties of Creative Commons licenses and the differences from other kinds of licenses, but Cliff Morgan did a very clear piece on that. And as I said, much more on other aspects, what are the roles of aggregators, all kinds of things. And we're always looking for more on that. So what's this day about? We can be fairly flexible on the format. Please feel free to chip in or ask at any time. I do have some questions here, which I can put to the panel, but do follow up or ask your own as we go. They do roughly, I've tried to group them, but I can't quite group them properly. I thought, with your permission, I'll start with one we got in on an email about 3 weeks ago. And I'll start with that because it's a nice sort of general question. I can put the first panel member on the spot. So I'll read that question out and then get people's reaction to it. It goes, I'd like the panel's feedback on the future of publishing for societies and where they think publishers should be concentrating their efforts to best support societies and associations as they and their membership feel the economic pinch. So this is publishers. I think the person was from a major commercial publishers, so they're thinking about the relationships between publishers and societies. So there's an obvious starting point there. So I thought I'd ask Bob to chip in, who's also done a very good article in Learned Publishing with Alice Meadows about the future, what he sees as the future in scholarly publishing. So Bob.
All right. Well, thanks, Alan. Yes, well, I'll start with part of the question, feeling the financial pinch, because that's probably what drives publishers, drives self-publishing societies to join up with publishers and give up self-publishing. And of course, there's no very easy answer to that one. And the relationship between the publisher and the society will depend on the nature of the society. And so we publish for some very large societies who can employ a very good publishing manager themselves. And the other end of the spectrum might be a small humanities society where there are very few publishing skills within the society, and we would just be dealing more or less with the editor and problems when there's turnover in society offices. So there isn't a sort of basic core of knowledge within the society. So that it's very difficult to give you one answer when, you know, we publish for 840 publisher societies, so there is a huge range. But I think the money is the main issue, and as most of you here will know, when contracts go out to tender, the main question really is how much money can the publisher earn for the society, and how much of that can they guarantee, and for how long. And I've heard some societies be quite cynical on this and say, well, we don't think this marvellous income stream is going to last forever, so we want to grab as much as we can while we can. And, you know, I've heard several societies say that, while some other societies might say, this is very much part of our mission to disseminate developments in the subject. It's very much to do with the status of the society, to keep high profile for the journal, and they are more concerned often about sustainability and maintaining the journal. And so when you are working with societies, obviously you've got to understand exactly what they want, and I think the rule is you don't go in with a set concept of what you are as the publisher and all the marvellous things you do. You've got to really listen to the society and build around that society what exactly is required. So listen rather than tell, I think, is the advice there. But certainly over the last decade, the movement has been from self-publishing to society, to the large publishers. And yet, 20 years ago, we saw the biggest threat to our business was societies deciding to self-publish. And the editor might know somebody who, quite common in those days, perhaps have a nephew who ran a small printing press or something, and would come along and say, look, we can do the journal more cheaply and more effectively. So there were 20 years ago, there were some contracts went the other way, societies self-published, but now there is quite a steady stream of self-publishers giving up. But that's probably the wrong term. They're not actually giving up. They're giving up being self-publishers, but they usually maintain a lot of expertise. So we talk about it being a partnership, and we actually learn quite a lot from those society officers who are running the publishing, and they've become a major part of the scholarly communication system. I think one of the newer elements, obviously, the obvious one is open access, concerns about open access, and society's hoping that publishers might have an answer on that. Well, I think as we wrote in that recent article in Learned Publishing, there isn't an easy answer. But the system is still relatively stable, and we haven't seen a very fast swing over to open access. I think our subscription journals last year, they attracted 12% more submissions, and I think that's always a good indicator of how healthy the system is. So one's looking at ever improving the journal publishing system based on the traditional model, but also adapting to the demand for open access. And so I guess most of you are operating the hybrid model, which isn't doing particularly well, and now looking at perhaps launching an open access journal or converting existing journal to open access. And then the other model that's gaining ground, as you all know, is the, which you might call the cascading model, where you pass articles on to an open access journal that have been rejected or are out of scope. And that's been the big development at Wiley-Blackwell, is we've launched and launching a whole program of sort of cascade journals supported by a number of societies, and they are passing articles onto those new journals and gaining a knowledge of how you organize an editorial office, the workflow differences to handle articles that we like to say have been alternatively selected. And so that's been quite a lively area for the last year. And one or two societies have decided to stay on their own and run some independent policy on open access, but the vast majority are coming in supporting our cascade journals, sharing the data, getting all the feedback. So they're in a position to either carry on being linked to one of our titles or learning enough to be able to understand how they might launch their own cascade title. So I think we're going to see a lot of activity with that model. And the other development is, especially the larger societies want advice on other aspects of what they do. In their mission statements, there'll be usually quite a lot about disseminating issues around the subject and getting involved in policy. And so we're increasingly finding ourselves advising societies on those other activities. They don't necessarily make money for the society, but it is an area where publishers can work with societies quite effectively. And we even now run seminars for our clients, as you might call, or partners, on lobbying in policy areas, and that's proving very popular. So I've probably spoken enough to start us off, but...
Can I ask just follow up on the mentioned cascade channels? Do any of those involve more than one society going into a single journal? In other words, a sort of cooperation, or are they all separate?
They're all really, at the moment, supported by quite a number of societies, so it's a group effort. So we've built a journal called Ecology and Evolution, where several journals are supporting it. And in microbiology, about 10 societies have signed up to support that one title.
Because that's kind of an interesting development if you've got them cooperating within the publisher. That's quite unusual, sort of. Break from the past,
herding cats. Yes, but it's quite a nice option for them because societies are very worried about what they call diluting their brand. So, on the whole, they don't want to be directly involved in a cascade title because they feel it'll have lower standards and it would diminish that brand that they've spent decades building up. So the advantage of offering a sort of bucket in the general subject around is that they can gain experience of open access publishing and handling cascade titles and articles without perhaps risking damaging their flagship.
So can I ask a question? Do they get, do the societies who, with the author's permission, transfer the papers to the open access journal, do they get revenue based on acceptance or submission of articles going into
acceptance.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. So the each supporting journal gets money back on based on the articles that are actually published in the Cascade title.
Well, it would be interesting if anybody else has any questions or feedback on them. Oh, Susan. Sorry, if they want to. It's because it's all being recorded.
Oh, okay. No, I think there's something I didn't quite understand about the Cascade Journal. So it's been refereed and it's been rejected by these other journals and then it gets moved in.
Yeah.
But the referees reform report presumably tells you that it's correct, it's just not interesting enough for this previous journal. Is that? I mean, how does. I don't quite see. Because you seem to be sort of. Starting from the premise, this has got to be a second-rate journal if it's been...
Yes. Where PLOS One has been so successful is it hasn't got a second-rate image. It's got this sort of aspirational appeal, which has been very clever. Because they were never very open about being a Cascade title. In fact, PLOS One was, as you know, launched by taking all the rejected articles from the big PLOS titles. But... that was never very clear. They just talked about this different way of peer reviewing articles, just going for whether the method was sound or whether the conclusions were sound, rather than making a judgment on how original the work was. And it was proved brilliantly successful. It's very difficult to train peer reviewers to work that different way, and even PLOS admit that hasn't really what's happened. Our societies have been, every one of them has been very nervous about being associated with lower standards. So actually, they're not sending all the rejected articles to the Cascade title. They are selecting titles, articles that were pretty marginal, that only just got rejected. So you don't get very many articles from each supporting journal, but you also get the out-of-scope articles. So the problem there is you don't get articles coming in with reports from reviewers because they've been they're in the out of scope category, so it's really like having a direct submission, and all these titles do have direct submissions as well.
They run it in other places. Biomed Central has quite an effective cascade mechanism where submissions to their top ranking journals, if they're rejected not because of methodological incorrectness, but because they are uninteresting or slightly out of scope, then they can, with the author's permission, be resubmitted to another journal. They acknowledge that the cascading journals down the line are lower quality, but they would argue they're not substantially lower quality. They're just slightly different.
Yeah, they're quite open about it, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it's an interesting sort of theoretical concept with the PLOS One. They can turn it around to say, well, this is really for the community to decide later, so we have minimum threshold publishing. It's a nice phrase that Philip Campbell.
Philip Campbell used to
coin minimum threshold publishing, which Nature and many big societies are doing, and let the community sort it out later. But it's got to be correct. So they're sort of having it in between. Sorry, Tony. You want
Tony O'Rourke, IOP. Actually, Pippa said just about what I was about to say. We don't, IOP doesn't have a Cascade Journal per se. We've looked at the Cascade Journal for the last 5 years in some form, not because of the papers that we reject, but there are so many papers that are submitted to so many of our journals, particularly the larger journals, which are just out of scope. Mm. You know, they're good papers, good solid research papers, maybe not Nobel Prize winning papers, but certainly they're bringing that an aspect of the science forward. But if it doesn't meet scope, then we can't publish them. It does a disservice to the journal they were submitted to. So the issue really is one of protecting the publisher's brand and producing something that isn't going to undermine the value of peer review and the value of the other journals that we have in our list.
Yes, I know a publisher that is essentially thinking of doing a Cascade Journal. Certainly not going to call it that.
No.
I mean, the journal of papers that are rejected elsewhere is kind of... Well, there is a Journal of Universal Rejection. You probably know about that.
If I could also make one comment, I think it's a clever approach because there is so much science out there that adds value, and so many editors and journals are so concerned about their impact factor or other issues that they're keeping their content very strict quality-wise, at least as they can attempt to at submission point. So I think there's plenty of room for these sorts of journals, and even in my organization, we self-publish, and our editors are rejecting so much that I'm concerned about the market share that we publish in oncology. One thing that I think is interesting is that the journals that are affiliated with Wiley-Blackwell then get a revenue piece for recommending the transfer to a Wiley-Blackwell Cascade journal. And that sort of can cause a little shift in what an author might otherwise do. So what other second-tier journal would that author have normally submitted their paper to when the journal that they had been rejected from is then recommending the journal that it should go to? So I'm wondering, I have no idea, and this is early phases of work, I'm wondering if that will force a shift that would not have not come naturally by a larger publisher publishing on behalf of societies and the authors, often taking the lowest barrier for the next stage of their submission. Not a bad thing. Societies need money. That's just a point I thought that was worth bringing up.
Well, it is with Biomed Central, BMC, they are fairly open about saying their reason for the Cascade is to keep the author publication fees within Biomed Central.
Mm-hmm.
So that because it's quicker and easier for the articles which have been rejected from the top journals to be considered by the next tier. They may still be rejected.
Mm-hmm.
They do still undergo a quality control basis, but it's easier for the authors, and it's obviously better for the publishers because you keep the author publication fee within that. And as Bob said, then if it's in association with societies, then there is a return to the societies for that, mm-hmm. which again makes it more attractive to be with a publisher who's operating a standard like that.
But if there are no submission fees or such, then the author's initial choice of a second tier journal to go to may or may not have been where the influence is. Not a bad thing. Just an issue to think about.
So does the panel think then that Cascade Publishing is going to lead to a reduction in the number of journals? If you may think about the process, we reject a journal from our particular high prestige value journals. It goes to the next journal of the chain, the next journal of the chain, until it gets published somewhere. Every paper effectively gets published somewhere. By producing Cascade journals, they stay within our publishing groups. They don't go anywhere else. So the second and third rate journals will disappear. So in a sense, Cascade Publishing, this sort of bucket publishing is a good thing. It's going to get rid of some of the crap.
It could replace some of the. It could replace some of the journals. The other arguments that go for it are the kind of efficiency of the review process, because you would argue that it only needs to. You can perhaps take those same referee reports, mm-hmm. and use them lower down rather than going to a new journal and starting all over over again. Of course, there are other ways that people try to do that with peer review consortia and so on. But I don't know, do people think it's going to reduce the number of journals?
I could see, I mean, there are already more of the big plus one type of journals being launched, and I can see more of those because from a publisher's point of view, they're more cost effective because you're getting more papers through. If you've got a lower threshold for acceptance rejection, and particularly if you're running on author fees, if you're running on publication fees, you actually want to accept everything, not to reject anything, because a rejection costs you money. From a business point of view, not from an ethical point of view. Right. And so I could see that there would be more of those because they are more efficient.
Susan?
The question then that arises from that, because we have seen a growth in plagiarism as well as a growth in these bucket journals, and I wonder whether there is a connection there, because it's clear that if your peer review process from the top journal is deciding, first of all, whether it's interesting or not, the top journal will probably pick only the ones which are unlikely to have been plagiarised. But then the other stuff, I mean, how much work is being put into ascertaining whether the sort of PLOS One type article, if all you're doing is saying, well, look, it's okay, it's correct, perhaps that's also a very good source of, you know, it's open to abuse because there's less checking going on.
It's really very good. Both those points are meant to other questions that we've got here, so that's good. But did you want to respond to that? About are we going to see more plagiarism? Because I'm not quite sure I followed the logic that there's going to be less checking.
Yeah, in defense of the Cascade or the second-tier journals or third-tier journals or whatever they might be, it doesn't necessarily have to be lesser quality and not have some of the same checks in line, so I'm not, I wouldn't, you know, think that that would be an attempt of any publisher. I think there is more plagiarism going on, and I will get into a little bit of that in my presentation. But in fact, some groups are checking right or wrong papers more carefully from certain communities who more frequently plagiarize because it's part of their natural, part of their customs, and they haven't been brought up in the same sort of educational system and approach to research publishing as some US, UK sort of approaches.
I'll just add another society feature. Societies are always asking us what other benefits can we introduce for members to encourage people to join and stay joined. So with this system, if they're a member, they get a discount on the publication fee. And that is actually quite significant. It's rather like when it was the hard copy journal and a member would get a journal for, let's say, $20, while the common price might have been hundreds of dollars. And you could argue that. And when you did surveys of membership, that was the main reason they joined the society, was to get the journal cheap. Well, now possibly people will see a very important membership benefit is that they can publish in the society's journal at a lower author fee, similar amounts of saving.
I think that maybe there is a question about, is there any future for small and specialist journals, which touches on this landscape of what things might look like. Just one comment on the societies. I found it interesting that at a time when there's communities that have been quite hostile to publishers and commercial publishers, that's also had, in my view, an effect on societies and making them more nervous about the future of their journals, and rather ironically has pushed more societies towards commercial publishers to come in under their umbrella as a sort of safety net. And that's quite surprising in one way that that's had that kind of effect. Another thing I'd mention is, having done some consultancy for some societies, I usually ask them, if they're thinking of moving publisher, have you thought of doing this yourself, just to ask the question. In some cases, they've been very powerful societies, and objectively, they possibly could. And they're kind of intrigued by that idea until they get anything like sight of a proposal from a publisher. And those proposals to publish a journal can be anything, up to 150 pages. And of course, there's a lot of hype in all those, but it normally terrifies the society simply because of not only this fear of what's happening with the economic pinch, but the number of technical things that people now have to do in publishing, particularly in the electronic world, on the marketing side, and those kinds of things. Usually, that makes us, often makes a society think, I can't do that. Never mind, you possibly could outsource a lot of it. They often have that kind of reaction, which pushes them that way.
And I guess as I'm the self-publisher society here, yeah. I feel I need to say something about that. And having also been in the commercial side and also tried to bring on society publishers as customers, there are many societies that should not be publishing, and I truly believe that. But then there are some who should, and I can tell you AACR is certainly one of them. But there are some things that are the benefit of being with a larger group one way or another, whether it's contracting with a commercial publisher, and it's the expertise that you get. In a smaller society, you don't have all the expertise that you need in terms of electronic or certain business models, or being able to experiment, and more importantly, things like being able to get good pricing for things because of your volumes that you can get economies of scale for. So those are all very good reasons for some publishers to publish with a commercial publisher, and it's not easy on that side either, because societies can be quite a challenge to work with. Not all of them, mind you. But there's benefit to self-publishing, and there's still a role for and a time for many of us to do that. And we can band together and have our own group of experts and go-to people to learn from and to help each other through various processes.
And if I would say, we publish very small societies, and they're completely decentralized. Editors are all over the country, the world, and our role is then very much to work with them, just for the sort of organizational, sending out renewals, membership dues, collections, these sorts of things, where they just simply don't have the resources.
Yeah.
Or organization to really get together.
I think the point, a bit of a plug for ALPSP, to make the point that Bob said they publish for 840 societies. ALPS has 350 societies. I bet not many of those 840 are members of ALPSP. It's a great shame that when the society decides to have a publisher, they think they shouldn't be in ALPSP anymore. Which is extraordinary, really, because almost contrary to what Bob said, a lot of the societies lose any kind of expertise or association that they had with publishing and just say the publisher looks after that now, and they worry about the bottom line, perhaps. And then 5 years later, they think, well, what should I be doing? And had they stayed members of ALPS, they might have been able, it would have been perhaps easier for them. So there's a kind of market out there for ALPSP. There are thousands of learned societies who could benefit from that. So if you go to a publisher, you're currently a society, you go to a publisher, stay with ALPS, I guess. Is that all right, Sarah? Yeah, good. Okay. We had a question about, is there a future for small specialist journals? And that, I think, goes into the points that we were making about what's the future scenario is going to look like. And one, I think you were beginning to touch on, one scenario that is posited is that there will be a series of major plus one type journals, maybe 10 or something. And that will kind of be the underbelly, as it were, of publishing. And in that environment, good specialist journals might nevertheless thrive. That's one sort of scenario. How do panel members think it might all turn out in sort of 15, 20 years?
I guess I worry a bit about sort of diversity and conformity. So I think that the smaller, maybe they're second tier, but they have a different, I think their role is often to push at the margins and to sort of, they tend to be a bit more experimental, they tend to be a bit less conformed, and I feel like they have an important role to play in sort of developing the discipline, even if it's from what's initially seen as somewhat, as I said, experimental or counter grain, whereas I feel like a lot of the large journals tend to be, they have quite an ideology of the society, let's say, or they can push quite mainstream ideas. And I feel that the smaller journals often play an important role in pushing those boundaries a bit.
Mm-hmm. So the diversity is pretty important for academia and scholarship.
Yeah,
right?
I think so.
I mean, I could see a future where you have effectively one repository where all the articles that are methodologically correct are published, but then you have overlay journals owned by societies or commercial companies that pick and select effectively a subsection of that to serve a specialist market. Mm-hmm. Because one of the issues is that journals serve a whole variety of purposes, and for a lot of societies, whilst they are a means of publishing original research and maybe making some money, they're also a means of talking to your community, of telling them about the next conference, of telling them about your membership, of publishing your annual report. And so, you know, they serve a different purpose, that it really is outside the scope of the research journal per se. So I could see there being a completely different cut of the way articles are published.
I agree. I don't think there's going to be journals, separate journals, some time in the future, 10 years from now or whatever, I have no idea, but the idea of separate journals is not gonna matter so much, but there's still gotta be, in my mind, some sort of vetting service where you can have that stamp of approval, and so there's so be some sort of rating system, because we still need to filter. Drinking from the fire hose, there's too much information out there, you know, you want to drink distilled water and just enough of it, instead of drowning by everything that is out there. So I don't know that journals in the way they're packaged now and how it's all being done is going to be the way it is going to be in the future, but the vetting still, I think, is going to matter.
I mean, just to say, the Korean model that we saw yesterday actually is a case in point, is there you have a database. You know, PubMed Central, you have a database of articles, and then from that you get subsets. At the moment, they're feeding, the databases are being fed in from the subset.
Yes, it can't exist without the other system, yeah.
But I wonder if at some point it's going to turn and feed the other way.
Bob, do you?
Yes, as having published journals for so long, I take that point that it's, these small titles are often fun. You get to know a small community, it can become a large community. So I think we will still see so-called niche titles alongside big buckets, as we've been calling them. I don't see them going away. It's just human nature. They want to have their, you know. And some of them have led to very largest journals. Some of them just grow and grow. So it's the way you keep the list moving.
Right. Any other things about future scenarios? What they think it'd be? Ian.
Can I just follow up on Pippa's point, which I don't think I agree with. I'm not sure I agree with it, because I think again it confuses two different purposes of scholarly publishing, and it's this business again about access versus authority. And I think those big databases are very good at providing access. But if you have the big bucket, as Bob says, you still need some way of sifting the literature so that academics can get to the trustworthy content they want really quickly. So there has to be some, you know, in a sense it doesn't matter what the container is, but there has to be some signposting to say this is where you want to go. And I think if you had those big databases at some point, the communities would start sort of crystallising out anyway and form their own groups within the big bucket. Would you agree?
Oh, no, I agree entirely. It's I guess the point I'm making is at the moment we have a landscape of small and large journals that currently in some areas feed into large databases. And I'm saying at some point I can see it actually going the other way around. Is that an academic gets accreditation for their article appearing in X repository where it has been peer-reviewed and it's got the stamp of approval, maybe an open-access PubMed Central type repository. Now, I haven't worked all of this out, so the peer review system is still up, but then from that you'll get subsets. And just to say, it's already happening to a certain extent with Faculty of 1000. Where they're effectively doing a subset for their community of what is the good stuff that's being published.
Yes. Sorry, Susan, can I just go?
You've got to be recorded there, yeah. as you know.
Yeah, I get that, but again, peer review isn't just the process of sending some work to, I know you know this, but you know, it's not just the process of sending the work to another academic to have a look at and say whether it passed muster or not. In the current system, the really important complementary side to that that helps sift the literature is the network, the pecking order of the journals, so that you could have the same paper sent to the same two referees, but if they were assessing it for Nature, they might not publish it, and if they're assessing it for another journal, they may publish it, because they're looking at it through the lens of that journal, and that journal is a lot of things. It's that come about from the investment of the publisher and the work of the editors, and you know, blah 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 blah. Mm. And so, unless it's not, what I'm trying to say is, it's not just a case of going through a peer review process. There's the authority on the literature comes from that network and pecking order of the journals, and that's the part that I think would be very difficult to replicate in any other sort of system that we've heard discussed.
Yeah. I take your point, but I wonder, you know, what will be the effect of academia and their own peer review systems, and whether they'll start implementing something like this future. I don't know.
Susan?
I find it very hard to believe that when you start with the premise of cascade journals and bucket publishing of mediocre work, that somehow out of this is going to spring the few elite new interesting things, because they don't come from that community. I mean, when we look at things which have come up in the past that are excellent and then have formed excellent journals, they come from small communities who are doing something exciting, who get together, and in a large number of cases it was people like Robert Maxwell who went in there and spotted these communities and did the facilitating. Now, that sort of thing is not coming out of bucket publishing. And the, I find the faculty of 1000 a completely unbelievable basis of finding this stuff, because basically you're trying to pick out what's the best of mediocrity rather than starting from the premise there are a few guys here working on something really exciting, they're talking to each other, and I've got more faith in something like the Polymath project that I was talking about a couple of days ago, actually developing into a new journal, than it would come out of this sort of mass base level. That's just opinion.
Well, it depends on the social systems that which we're operating in a way, and it seems, just from my own personal view, that it seems more plausible that people will want to get together and do their own thing to show the distinction from it. Yeah. So a scenario with the buckets, but separate and differently generated specialist high-quality journals is more plausible to me, because in a sense a journal is an expression of a community.
Can I just say impact factor 4.19?
Yep.
Which is plus one.
But that's
what people take notice of.
Yeah. Who thinks that that's important? I really do.
One thing that could happen out of these bucket journals is there's new emerging areas that crop up, and they don't really have a home, and those mature famous homes don't want them because they don't really see that they're fitting within their scope. They may find themselves publishing in these bucket journals, and then as people start mining that data and that area starts to grow a little bit, then that group may form its own community and become a group that no longer publishes in bucket journals. That's our description.
That's right. Robert?
Hi. Robert Parker from the Royal Society of Chemistry. I think the community thing is a terribly important thing, but this is only from our own experience. It could be very different for other subject areas. Where we have had experience of producing very successful new journals, it's been on the back of building a community first. So we will usually start off with building a conference or seminars at a bigger conference around subject groups and bring a group of people together. Then we might get a group of people to write a multi-author book or something, but you start building a community and you build up to a journal. One example of this we did relatively recently, is energy and environmental science, which doesn't sound like a very new area, but there was an awful lot of work going into energy. And we built a community around the chemical science aspects of energy. We started conferences, getting them together. Then we launched a journal. That journal has been massively successful in terms of content, and its first impact factor was 9 point something, and it came in as number one in the impact factor rankings. Yeah. And that was on the basis of building community. And that is the opposite of buckets, I think.
You could also say it's a kind of Maxwellian view, who, in some cases, Robert Maxwell actually started a learned society so that he could publish a journal for it. I wanted to ask Tony about one area, the archive, for example, in physics, in one case, completely comprehends one of your journals. And that's often been touted as being a... All we need is overlay journals on archive and then it disappears. What would be the sort of current thinking on that kind of concept?
Well, the archive covers a number of...
This is a preprint database, I should say, mainly in not only, but mainly in high-energy physics.
The archives at Cornell University was started by Paul Ginsbach from the Los Alamos Laboratory in 1991 and covers a number of pretty fundamental areas of physics, has some astrophysics, particularly strong area. What's true is that it certainly overlaps in content. Tim Inglesby from AIP a few years ago wrote an excellent piece where he analysed, he took the assumption that articles that are in archive don't need to be published. And what he found out was something like 97% of articles in high energy physics, which is a very, very popular area in archive, also appeared in peer-reviewed journals. Now, the question isn't whether, and this is kind of goes back to the session we had on Tuesday, the question isn't whether the archive or similar repositories are taking away the content. It's whether those repositories and archives are taking away the usage and changing the reasons why the journals are being used. In high energy physics, for example, one of the highest impact factor journals in high energy physics, the Journal of High Energy Physics, had fantastic, it was an impact factor of 6. Yet, when IOP had the journal, its use was at best medium level because people weren't using the journal to read the content, they were using the archive. They were simply using the journal for the validation and the citation.
Yeah. There's a new concept of the write-only journal.
Yeah.
Nobody reads, which is kind of interesting. I'm wondering whether we should completely change tack now because we're more than halfway through and come up with the new scenarios of way the things may go. We have a number of we have questions and have already mentioned things like plagiarism is on the increase and so on. And I thought this might be a time to is segue the right word?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, into a discussion of what's happening in terms of ethics in publishing and plagiarism. So and I actually asked Diane to do something on that. So maybe we could. Move over to that.
Yeah, so we'll go ahead and get started. And I have been asked to talk about promoting ethical publication practices. And regardless of what I say, my message is that publishers and editors are part of a bigger system, and it's not something that we alone should be doing. So as a publisher, you might expect me to think about the cost of allegation of ethical violations. And those costs are pretty hefty. They don't come cheap. There's intangible and tangible costs. And here are some of the groups that are affected by some ethical violations. Society as a whole can be negatively impacted when there's a loss in public trust and in terms of the scientific research and medical practice. So without trust in the scientific approach and our reporting of it, then there's loss of faith and the public won't drive the government to fund the research. And when those funds are misused, then there's other circumstances that arise, such as allowing drugs to be prescribed that are based on faulty or false information. And then talk about public trust being shaken, it is. And you hear about that a lot in the news, and of course the news is created to sell newspapers. So there's a lot of good science going on that you never hear about it, but when there are problems, then there's a lot of talk about it. So besides wasting money and funds being misdirected by the scientific community, there's a loss in productivity. The science research and careers are derailed, and it can result in even having fewer people enter the sciences, which is, I think, a big problem. So allegations or findings of misconduct can cause institutions to have difficulty getting grants, donations, faculty, and even patients. So journals, publications, and mostly I talk about journals here, journals that do a lot of retractions and corrections can be seen as not taking proper care in their editorial and publishing practices. But these days, you might say, if you're not doing retractions and corrections, the reverse is happening. So going on, taking a look at the various definitions, and that's it. There are various definitions and a lack of standards among all the different stakeholders. Today we have the promise of team science that's interdisciplinary and involves people from all over the world, but they come with different customs and different practices. So in the United States, we have two major government funding bodies, the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation, and they both have different definitions of scientific misconduct, of research misconduct. Institutions sometimes define scientific misconduct different from the funding agencies or oversight bodies. So some institutions define misconduct beyond what the traditional backbone is, which is falsification, fabrication, and plagiarism, to include other serious deviations from accepted research practice. And yet the journal and the journal's owner may have another definition. So there's a gradient from the norm and some deviations from it to unethical behavior, to misconduct. If misconduct is intentional, it's much more difficult to detect and harder to see. If it is with impactful research, it's likely to be scrutinized by more people, the research to be repeated, and errors and problems to even get more attention. So that's a good thing, at least. Although for many ethical violations handled by journals, there's a standard backbone that you can try and approach. The Committee on Publication Ethics flowcharts are a good source. There's some information in the Council of Science Editors white paper on promoting good scientific publishing practices. So there are these foundations, but no two cases are alike. That would be a dream because we all have way too many of them, but if you can strive for a consistent approach, a fair, consistent approach, that's a good foundation. So you also need to treat your favorite editor-in-chief as well as a first-time author exactly the same, regardless what the politics are involved or what repercussions there may be on you as a staff person or a part of a larger organization. So as editors and publishers, we have a responsibility to attempt to prevent unethical behavior by establishing good, clear policies and practices, and then to promulgate those throughout all of our communication channels. We can take preventative action in a number of ways, and I've listed some of those, like in our instructions for authors, our instructions for reviewers. There's a whole host of ways that you can do it. You can require, authors to attest that they've conformed to your policy. But most importantly, we need to communicate and collaborate with other organizations and oversight bodies. And ALPS should be one of those groups involved in these things. So journals have many, many, many policies. It's never ending, and we're always creating more of those policies that go beyond FF&P, falsification, fabrication, and plagiarism to attempt to promote good practices and sharing of information and to deter unethical behavior. So here's just some of the policies that I've pulled out from journals, and I'm going to take a look at authorship as an example. So arguments among authors is really pretty common. Who gets credit impacts things like tenure and promotion, salary, fame and glory, and the professional standing of individuals in their scientific community. So there's a lot of interest for individuals to be first if you're publishing in one of those areas where being first means that you did most of the research and you'll also take most of the credit for it. So that's me first. It's also, I did as much as that first author, so it's me equally. I also want to be first, and sometimes there's more than two that want to be first. Then there's the Me Too approach. I wasn't listed in as author, but I should have been an author. And then finally, there's, oh no, not me. I'm not taking responsibility for this. But you usually don't hear about that until after the paper's published and there's some sort of problem that's come to light. At the Council of Science Editors in 2009, we pulled together a group of editors, about 50 editors from almost all the different scientific disciplines. And there was some consensus there, and it was that researchers, not editors, should determine who is an author. Editors should require authors to identify their contributions to the work. This authorship contributorship model is getting some traction. It's more common in medical journals, but it's where authors spell out their actual contributions, and those are things that they will take responsibility for. It's also helpful if there is a problem with misconduct or ethical violations, you might more easily be able to identify who's taking responsibility, and then all the authors might not go under the bus if there is a problem. So I have a couple examples. Journals usually, if there's authorship disputes, and those authorship disputes come about before a paper is published, you often say, okay, we're gonna just, you all take this back, you decide what you wanna do with it, and when you resolve the authorship issue, then you come back to us. Well, that usually works. Not always, though. I had a paper that was held hostage by an author. With the original version, he was in the third position. And the revised version, he was in the third position, and in each case agreeing to the submission that we received. When we're ready to accept yet the third version of the paper, he says, oh no, I need to be a co-first author. They couldn't resolve it amongst themselves, and the senior author finally had to go to the institution and have them engage. We had to make sure that we communicated with the author who was going to be put out of his authorship by the institution and the senior authors and the other co-authors saying, oh, we're going to go along without him. We will acknowledge all of his contributions. And just as we're about ready to publish that paper and take that step, which is a little unorthodox, then that third author decided, oh, he was happy in that place. Right thing to do or not, it's not always real clear. Another case that was interesting, you think that you have authorship disputes, and as a journal publisher, you don't have the data, so you can't really tell. How can you be involved in this? Well, we published a paper, and then we were sued. An author thought they should have been, a person thought they should have been named as an author. We go to the authors of the published paper and ask them to comment. And they say, oh yes, we're being sued too. And so are our two institutions that who employ us. So, you know, this is after a couple different filings and responses, we had to spend a few tens of thousands of dollars to defend ourselves in a case where we had nothing to confirm or deny. So that money could have been much better spent on cancer research. But it's a reality. So these authorship disputes come, and sometimes it's little misbehaviors, and other times it can be misconduct because of intellectual property theft. So it's something that we all deal with. There are claims, minor and major, but they're all time-consuming. So what can publishers do to work to detect? Well, we can do some screening for ethical violations or non-compliance of our policies for our journals. Examples might include using plagiarism detection software, forensic tools to look at image manipulation, whether it's simply beautification beyond what your policies and instructions call for, to something like fabrication of data. We can do quality checks to make sure different people involved in the process follow our practices, such as deposit information in clinical trials. We can ask authors and reviewers to look for and report any ethical concerns they might have. But it's not enough to look. We need to take some action, and we have an obligation to take action. We got to consider any allegations, regardless where they come from. And many of us are getting anonymous allegations, and certainly dealing with them. And some of those anonymous allegations result in things that we have to correct the literature for. So along this process in considering allegations, we have to make sure that we do it very carefully. We maintain confidentiality. There's people's reputations and careers that are at stake. We need to do it in a very timely way, but the process is very, very linear, from asking questions of those involved to finding out independently certain facts, if you can, and then trying to be objective in the decisions that you make. And if you have an allegation that seems to have enough merit to it, then turning it over to the institution that should have the tools to investigate the situation. Journals do not investigate. So one of the important roles of editors and publishers is to correct the literature, and they have to do this very carefully. They should impose sanctions, or at least societies too should consider them. Inform and collaborate with stakeholders. There's not a good communication between funding bodies and journal policies, and even the Office of Research Institution doesn't consider the journals a need to know when they're investigating or having a finding of misconduct. They will require the author to, if there's a finding, they will say to the author to notify the publisher, but that's sort of a backdoor approach. It's certainly not strong enough. So we need to work together with our stakeholders to promote good research and publication practices to deal with so many of these complexities, because now we have the international interdisciplinary approach to science and its communication. And taking this action has costs associated with it. And here's just some of the tangible ones. There's staff time, there's the forensic tools that we need to buy and pay for, talking about our business models where we need to do everything cheaper and more efficiently. Yet we're doing all these other things as well. Getting expert opinion, sometimes we will want to do that before we even turn it over to an institution. And yes, there are legal fees, so those may be more of something from the U.S. Than elsewhere. So the costs are quite substantial, and we're not going to be able to eliminate all kinds of fraudulent behavior. But I'd say our goal is to minimize it. And through education, screening, policing, sanctions, they're all important, but they're not the sole responsibility of publishers and its owners. So some of it, I believe, really needs to be done much farther upstream. Certainly in the educational system, at institutions, and through funding bodies. I just thought, I was curious when I was thinking about this presentation, has there been an increase in retractions? And retractions, of course, can be from honest error. So I don't mean to imply that the increase, as you see from the numbers here, the year, I looked at every 2 years through 2010, you see there is an increase. And it usually takes 2 to 3 years for, once a paper is published, for a retraction to come about. So we are seeing more retractions. There's more things that we have to deal with.
What does that refer to, retractions from?
Oh,
what?
It's retractions from the notice that they're, it's from PubMed.
Oh, okay.
So I just did a search on PubMed for the article type retractions, and these are the numbers that came up. And of course, one retraction may report on more than one article being retracted. I know that I've done retractions that reported on, you know, 4 or 5 all in one retraction. So I'm showing here that, well, this is not really so surprising to me anyway, that there's more retractions being put out there. There's more research being done. There's more authors there. There's more articles. So it follows that this should happen. So dealing with our retractions, I just thought it'd be sort of nice to take a look at some of the practices that we should consider. Let me see. Okay. So here's the online journal of one of our journals. We have 7 journals at AACR, and so we point out the retraction, and now I have a red arrow, but I believe on our site now I've gotten our vendor to change it to red, so it's a little more obvious. So that's a retraction notice, and going back, you also see the retraction is the first thing you see in the title, along with the title of the original paper. You link through, and even when you go to the PDF, and linking through, you should be able to do that without any firewalls. Make sure it's freely available. You get through, you get to see the full text online. Downloading a PDF, we force a cover page, and that red box there shows the retraction. We stamp all of our retracted original research right across it. You can't miss it. And then, like it or not, we're going to force you to download the correction or retraction. So this is just some of the things that we do, and we believe it's very important for the building on the science that when you do publish retractions and corrections, you say why it's being retracted. And so that just was some of the things I thought might be of interest to this group.
I think it is. I like to ask people how if those are our publishers here, whether they're seeing more. I mean, there are a number of points to make. This is not just in medicine. There's an article in Physics World talking about 120 articles retracted from the Acta Crystalla Graphica, fairly recently. And it's also an issue that all publishers and the big publishers are very concerned about, and concerned to indicate that there are costs associated mm-hmm. with this, and it's something the publisher does. And the last point is that if you have a world where there are all sorts of versions out there, something that Irving mentioned the other day, the fact that it's retracted doesn't mean that it won't be cited or that it won't even be picked up in a different version in a repository somewhere. So there's a range of stuff. So I'd like to hear and what people are finding about themselves in this area.
Vicky Hammond, the Royal Society of Edinburgh. There's actually this question of co-authorship, multi-authorship. I've actually never come across it before. We're publishing the plenary volume of a Atlantic Earth Sciences Symposium which took place recently in Edinburgh. And one of the speakers has submitted his paper. I'll call him John Smith. John Smith et al. And so I sent him my standard acknowledgement email. Thank you for the submission. And can you please provide me with the names and affiliations of your co-authors and ask them to let me have their statements of agreement saying they agree with the content of the paper, its submission to the journal, and nominating you as the corresponding author, etc. And also his references were completely out of format of the correction, but that, you know, was another point. I got a very brusque, impatient email back from him saying, oh, This is rubbish. There's been a lot of input of this paper. This is my only way, standard way of acknowledging other people. I can't possibly name them all. It's a standard practice. And,
too many to name.
And I'm not going to waste time. No, nobody wastes time formatting references properly anymore. But, you know, that's not my job. So, yeah. But I think I should. Yeah. What are you saying? I should persevere.
They need a bit of education about this.
Yes. I mean, either he gives me the names of his co-authors or his collaborators, even if they're organisations,
yeah,
or else he puts them in the acknowledgements. You know, I think I should persevere and not let him get away with it.
To the extent that we can advise, we would say, yes, I'm sure we would.
I've actually never come across it before. They've just really...
Okay. Well, there are so many author disputes in various parts of the world. It's never mind what they acknowledge and what they don't acknowledge. And, of course, in medicine, I admit, for me, I knew a little bit about it, but the things that go on there with ghost authorship and lack of acknowledgement and so on are just astonishing. The one that I will mention the next issue is where they had access to the, through a court case, had access to the documents that had gone on through a pharmaceutical company, and it had one document, which was the version of the paper that said on it, author to be determined. And that was just about as shocking as you can find, I think, in that kind of thing.
Just comment on the group authorship or large number of authors, that can get to be a problem. Our policy is, for all authors, we collect the names and the email addresses, not necessarily all the contact information. So when we acknowledge a paper, everybody gets the acknowledgement, and everybody gets the letters along the way. And of course, if somebody doesn't know they're an author, that's a sign of it. But for group authorship in certain areas like astronomy and you know, higher energy physics, there are a huge number of authors. And so doing the contributorship model where people, you know, check, I did this, or outline what they did, that could be an issue, or some clinical trials. But still, we're going to give it the good old college try.
Sorry.
Robin Dunford, Society for General Microbiology. We're certainly seeing an increase in refractions and errata, that kind of thing. I think a lot of that, particularly with errata, is just ease of detection. I remain to be convinced that there's actually an increase necessarily in misbehaviour. I think that there is an increase in our ability to detect it, and an increase in how easy it is to do it, because people can just copy and paste. And in terms of retractions, I think we're seeing that, I would say, is coming from the pressure that researchers are under to publish. And I agree that I think perhaps these bucket journals are a potential cause of worry there, that they be authors who are under pressure to get, you know, pad out their publication lists all the time, might see that as a lower bar to get under in terms of either translating, as we, you know, hear people are doing, taking a Russian article, getting it translated into English and just republishing it with their name on, which people, you know, people are doing this kind of thing. So it's, yeah, I think it's kind of it's an arms race really going on with the ease of doing it and the ease of detecting it.
You're saying it's really, it's the ease of detecting, but you can't be sure if it were increasing, it'd be mixed up in that.
Mm-hmm. Actually, if I could just make a comment in defence of what we're calling the bucket journals. If you do look at PLOS and Nature and the big ones that are launching, PLOS One, I think, is a member of CrossCheck, and, you know, and I think if were they to hear us decrying their policies and leading to plagiarism, I think they would take offence with that, quite rightly, in some cases.
I think perhaps it's a perception, not a reality.
Yes, yes.
I'd like to make a comment about the plagiarism checking. If you look at, so there's value to this, and I personally would like to see that be one of the things that's done upstream. Many institutions have that software available to their researchers. And so for me as a small journal to take on that additional cost, you know, eventually I'm going to have to increase my pricing. And as a society self-publisher, I can tell you my costs are very favorable to the purchasers. So it is a time consuming. Right now I'm dealing with more of those because it is easier to detect. I got one the other day, 3 sentences separated in different parts of the introduction. You know, is that really anything that's going to make a difference in the world? No. And the ORI just came out with its 2009 report and had no findings of plagiarism. There could be 2 cases that are still open, not surprisingly. So I think it's important. I don't think it should be done. I think plagiarism checking, and even better if we could get any of our papers
if we could trust each other in some way to get any of our papers that are submitted to be tapped against each other's to avoid some duplicate submissions and other issues, that would be really great. We could correct some things before they actually got published. But, you know, it is something that, I don't know, I'm maybe an outlier, but I think that needs to be done upstream.
Just before we ask Helen to Robert, is it chemistry? Are you seeing an increase? Sorry about that.
I'm going to increase, but from a very low level.
Uh-huh.
The worry always is that you're not detecting it.
Yeah.
But it has been a very low level. We've had a very small number of retractions over the years, but we have had author disputes of the sort that Diane's talked about.
Yeah.
And they do take up, some of them these days take up a huge amount of time. They go on months and months and months. And they do, as Diane says, hold papers hostage.
Yeah.
One other thing I was going to mention, Bob, I don't know whether there's anyone else here who did, but Bob and I gave evidence to the UK Science and Technology Committee in Parliament on peer review, and they came out with a report which suggested that publishers generally are complacent about this issue. I'm not sure that any of us really responded to that, and I don't think we are complacent, but they thought we were.
Well, the whole report was dreadful, Robert. I think best forget the whole thing.
All the effort that went into it, there were a lot of. Yeah. I think the only good thing that came out of that is that some of the submissions, which are, I assume, they're still publicly available. Mm-hmm. Some of them, there were some outlier ones, as you might call it, but some of them were very good, including the one by ALPSP. So about peer review, so that was a good place to go. Just, I'm going to ask Helen, but just other areas, social sciences, humanities, is this an issue as far as we know?
It's not so much for us. I mean, we have the odd self-play. I mean, I think there is the pressure, of course, to publish, but I think there the journal article is just very much also the beginning of the book chapter that's in the monograph, and I think in that respect, the publication path is just the beginning. So it's a slightly different process in that respect.
Sorry, Helen, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Diana's, you know, a very interesting report. Only one question. And, you know, in the love science, the method section is plagiarism. We can say it's plagiarism, just the cast and post. It's very serious. So for this, I still have, I always want to get some correct answer. How to, you know, for example, your background is biology and the academic. So I want to get some idea. You know, what's your? Do you have some nice opinions? The first, this is for you. A second for Alan. You know, back to the first section. You know, for our small journals, you know, we can make the profit for the important things. We are academic journals, but for ARP, for Learn Publish, you know, how do you support your basic publish cost? Depend the advancement or depend what's a fees or depend the ARPSP association supporting
if I understood that, something about the economics of learning publishing, but the first one was about, I think, about cut and pasting methodology is one of the common forms of plagiarism and what we think about it.
I think it's one of those cases where the community needs to get together and make a decision about that. Having a paragraph or two that says it perfectly, that isn't going to change from one group to another. You know, I don't think that's where our big issues are. Our big issue is that we haven't come forth and decided what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. So if I were to get that now, I would have the person go back and rewrite if it was before publication. So I would still encourage all authors, don't do even one sentence of something unless you're quoting and giving attribution. But when it comes to the methods, I think we need to rethink that.
Yeah, I remember a quote from one plagiarism author who said, but that said it as well as it could be said. Why would I do it any other way? So it is an issue.
But I think the key there is attribution.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I don't see anything wrong in repeating a methodology section word for word, so long as it is fully attributed.
Yeah. I think so. Bob, I was going to ask you to, because I know the big publishers have got concerned that not only is all this costing them more, but it's another area that those who are anti-publisher don't even appreciate.
Yes, I think Dan has really given us a pretty comprehensive cover of that, and that was a very nice editorial that you wrote in Learning Publishing, which we've distributed to people as well, where your analogy with cancer detection and treating cancer. So I think it's such a good thing that Learning Publishing's picking this up, and Eleanor, you know, you'll carry on publishing pieces about this, which we can then...
We've done a lot on plagiarism.
We've rewritten, of course.
And we're going to group all the plagiarism articles that relate to the one, what the basic basis is on plagiarism law internationally and its variation with copyright and where it overlaps with copyright infringement and doesn't. And then a series, including one from Helen, about how it appeared, both cross-check and its implementation. And we'll carry on doing that. On learned publishing, you asked, I think, about learned publishing. I'll go into that by saying, when I was chair of the awards committee, we had one submission, which was all about design of journals, and we had one that came in, and I won't tell you what the title was, but it was exactly in this format. It looked identical to this, and it was clear that in some cultures, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, and that was still prevalent. If you were asking about the economics of learned publishing, it's reasonably healthy if that's what you were asking, and it's not acquired to make a profit. It just goes into the budget of ALPSP, and it does more than break even, depending on how you look at the more than break even. Unusually, for a relatively small journal, it gets quite a lot of advertising because it's a very niche community, which is something we forget about in a number of medical research journals to get those, and anything for a niche community that people really want to reach can get advertising. It's also a hybrid journal in the sense that it will take open access. There was discussion assertions yesterday about double dipping, which usually irritates me tremendously. We don't double dip on it, but what we tend to use if we get OA access fees is to publish more stuff, and it's kind of another approach. You use it to help the costs. So it's not obliged on any strategy to make a certain margin. It's not like that kind of... It's a different model from, say, a commercial publisher or a research society publisher that wants to make a lot of money out of its publications. So was that what you were asking, in a way? We can talk about it after, if I've got it wrong. Yeah, okay. And we're nearly finished.
I was
going to say that Pippa has something to say which goes back almost to the first stuff about outsourcing. We've only got a few minutes. I was going to say
I have a presentation and I'm only going to go through it because it took me half an hour to find the photographs for it. but I won't talk to it. It was really about outsourcing and I got a very good photograph of a mixed thing about the complexity of publishing. Is outsourcing the solution? And I think it is the solution for many societies, but not for all. And as Bob said, there's a whole mixed environment out there. And if you decide to outsource, actually knowing who to go to, again, because the situation is getting a lot more complex and many companies who previously offered just one service are now offering a whole variety of services, and it can get incredibly complex. And I put at the bottom, is it all about people? Because I've been involved in a couple of tender recently, and with both of them, at the end of the day, it went with the company that we liked because the offerings were so similar. And really, just the future, will the large publisher survive, and what is the future for other publishers? And I know this is an answer session, but I just put that in as a question part. And I hope you like my pictures.
Yeah, thank you. I think you would like the one on choice.
Yeah, that's great.
They were all a
Google search using Creative Commons as a filter.
So they are legal.
You've got permission.
Not Photoshop photos. Oh, certainly Photoshop photos.
And of course, they will be those who didn't get them as they whizzed by. They will be on the website. So I have them. So I'm sorry we didn't.
No,
get them.
No problem.
So any concluding questions or points, Ian?
I think, sorry, I just wanted to return to the point that was made about whether we're actually seeing an increase in scientific... Well, we seem to be seeing an increase in reported scientific misconduct and retractions and that kind of thing. But is it just because we are better at detecting it and we're, you know, because of electronic publishing, it's sort of easier to detect it and to correct it? Or is there... I'm just interested quickly in your views on whether you think that there is a genuine... increase in scientific misconduct and that sort of thing.
One quick response is that it's really awkward to say, but it seems to be clear and admitted from areas and certain cultural regions that are expanding rapidly into research without the cultural background that the normal science does, and that would lead to an increase in some areas. Very plausibly leads to thinking there would be an increase. It's not just detection. Whether it's also happening in pressures of the established research community, I wouldn't really.
I don't know.
I chose not to do that as an academic exercise. I just know we're having to deal with more. It seems very likely that we're having a spike because it's easier to detect certain things now. But we are publishing much more, and I think that's a good thing. There's more research being done. That's a good thing. So I'm the internal optimist to say, relatively, probably not. But I don't know.
Move down the line.
Well, I also wonder if we're just changing. I mean, I think the academic community has always been very good at peer reviewing and has had this culture. But I think overall as a society, if you look at something like Wikipedia, and I think sort of on a larger level, this sort of more of a social responsibility or sort of a larger claim to research as a broader property of a broader society in a way. So I wonder also if we're changing as how we approach and think we have the right to comment or to question or in a certain way. I don't know.
Bob, last word? Or Diane's going to say something.
No, I was going to ask
Pippa. Actually, it's been pretty well covered. I didn't have much to add.
I was just going to ask Pippa what one of her major take-homes are about outsourcing.
I think it needs to be treated incredibly carefully, and the main reason for that is because one of the issues I come up with, and again with one of the tenders I was involved with, is the company wanted a particular service. So they went to a company and they said, we want this service, and the company came back and they said, okay, we can give you this service, and we can give you this, and we can give you this, and we can give you this. And the company I was working with got very excited and went, right, well, in which case we can have this and we can have this and we might need this and we might need this. And the bill went up from an estimated 10 to about 50. And by the time I left, it was up to 100,000. And the problem is, again, because, you know, companies, you know, who used to offer typesetting and that was all they did, are now offering, for example, as an example, are now offering so many other services, it's very easy to ask for more than you really need. Mm-hmm. And I think that's to be very careful about what you really need and also who are the best people to go to. And it is about people and trust with people.
Okay. Well, my last irreverent thought on that is whenever I used to be asked at parties what I did for a living, and I said publishing, and then they said, well, what is that? Or, oh, you mean you print things?
Yes.
And so you end up not having to focus very hard on what exactly do you do, because almost everything you would that they thought you did, you outsourced.
Yeah, that's right. Who owns a printing press?
And also just to say, my last thought is, if you do outsource anything, actually, what is your business? You know, and I think that is also because
it causes that focus. Do you really do? Okay, well, I hope you found that. It was a question, a last question. Where was
did
that?
Did you want to ask?
Yes.
Ah, right. Just got time for the coffee.
Eleonora Degienė from Lithuania. What is your thoughts about many Lithuanian journals redirect plagiarism checking for reviewers? What is success for this way that reviewers, how many plagiarism they detect? Is there any survey or is there any numbers?
Yeah, no, I mean, reviewers are notoriously bad at detecting plagiarism.
Oh, I see. So
I think
it's surprising to me how many things the reviewers do pick up. So if you're targeting the right reviewers and if the field is small enough, they do pick up some things relying on them. And reviewers are not spending as much time reviewing anymore. They don't have as much time, so that's a big problem. So they do detect, and I'm surprised at how many they do detect, but should we rely on them? No.
It would require
a reviewer to have a wide view of the literature, and in certain fields, that literature is vast, and it's different. If you take, there are two areas in physics. You take high-energy physics, the community often knows each other to a certain extent. And people would say, in archive, you don't need anything in high energy physics. Don't need any system because everybody knows it. It's not quite true. But then you take solid state physics, which is the largest area of physics, absolutely huge. Nobody knows anything about where else is going. So that sort of helps describe it. I think we'll have to call it because people want their coffee. Could you? I hope you found that reasonably interesting. And if you could join with me in thanking the panel members for all their help.